Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
A capsule of space dust arrives on Earth. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. A sample of dirt and rocks from the asteroid Bennu has arrived back on Earth, thanks to NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission. The capsule of ancient space dust touched down Sunday, and scientists are eager to get their hands on the sample. What might they find? We'll speak with Jessica Barnes, a mission scientist, on the future of the cup of cosmic dust. Then, Firefly Aerospace launched a rocket in record time. We'll speak with CEO Bill Weber about a Space Force demonstration mission that pushed his team to the limits. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Seven years ago, NASA's OSIRIS-REx launched on a mission to the asteroid Bennu, some hundreds of millions of miles away.
Go, OSIRIS-REx.
Everyone is go. Standing by for launch. After liftoff, you'll hear the voice of United Launch Alliance's Marty Malinowski providing launch vehicle ascent data. 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And liftoff of OSIRIS-REx, its seven-year mission to boldly go to the asteroid Bennu and back.
Its task was to gobble up a sampling of asteroid dust and return it back to Earth. Well, that dust returned to Earth Sunday in the safety of a tightly sealed capsule that landed in the Utah desert. Now, scientists will examine the sample that they think may have the key to how life got started on our planet. Here to talk more about the science findings to come is Jessica Barnes, an assistant professor at the University of Arizona and member of the OSIRIS-REx team. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here with such an exciting mission. Take us back to Sunday when this capsule arrived. I've got to imagine that this was a really, really incredible moment for both yourself and your colleagues on the OSIRIS-REx team.
Absolutely. It was such a special day. In fact, I still feel like I'm riding the high. I can't quite believe that the sample is safe and sound back on Earth. I wasn't in Utah or in Houston, where many of my colleagues are assembled. I was in Tucson, the University of Arizona, is leading the OSIRIS-REx mission. So it was, I think, equally special to be at the U of A when the parachute opened. That's when I knew, okay, the capsule is going to be okay. It's going to land safely on Earth. Really special to be able to share that, not just with colleagues on the mission, colleagues in the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory who are not part of the mission, but also our friends and family. It was just such a great day.
This has been quite an exciting mission, both from liftoff to arrival at Bennu, and how OSIRIS-REx kind of discovered some unexpected things about the asteroid itself, and now this capsule is back home. Tell us a bit about your role in the future of this mission. While the capsule has arrived, the work is just beginning here on Earth, right?
Correct, yeah. And in fact, the mission doesn't end, so we have 2 years to analyze a sample. But in the meantime, the spacecraft has now diverted and is going off to a different target, and now it has a new name. So it's no longer OSIRIS-REx. The spacecraft is now called OSIRIS-APEX, and that's because it has a new target, the asteroid Apophis, and so we're really excited for that extended mission, as well as the exciting work that we have to do over the next 2 years. So I joined OSIRIS-REx in January of 2020, right before the pandemic, and my role is I'm a co-investigator, and I'm the lead scientist for the Sample Elements and Isotopes Working Group. So I will be working with a fantastic group of international scientists to understand the origins, the makeup, the chemistry of the return sample.
And Jessica, just remind us why this is so exciting to scientists like yourself. What are you looking for in the sample? You know, what question do you hope to answer with this analysis?
So we have many questions about this sample that we want to address, and that's based on years and decades of research into meteorites, which are natural samples of asteroids that fall to Earth every day, and also studying materials brought back from other space missions like the Hayabusa and Hayabusa 2 missions, both run by JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, which brought back material from other asteroids. And so we have a lot of questions both from previous work, but also from studying Bennu up close and personal. I think for me, the most exciting thing and something that drives a lot of my personal research is trying to understand the origins, nature, distribution of water in the earliest parts of our solar system and how water was delivered to Earth. That's what drives a lot of my research and interest. But I'm also really keen to see how old are the materials that make up Bennu and where did they come from and how did the asteroid that we know and love as Bennu come to be? So yeah, there are lots of exciting questions.
And those answers are trapped in this sample of dirt?
Yes, believe it or not, dirt can tell us a lot when it's asteroid dirt. And so, so we'll be looking at the minerals and the chemistry of the sample as a whole and the organic molecules. We'll be looking at the as a team, a wide team of 200 plus people worldwide. We'll be looking at the physical properties, as I said, the isotopic composition, the elements to piece together Bennu's history from the materials from which the parent body from which Bennu formed or made of, how the parent body was disrupted and re-accreted to form the rubble pile asteroid we know, looking at its history all the way from when it was in the outer solar system to when it was brought to the asteroid belt to when it was even brought to nearer space. Believe it or not, a dirt sample can trap all of that history, and we're really looking forward to untangling it.
I want to chat a bit about the sample itself, because I remember visiting the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft before it launched in one of the clean rooms. And, you know, there was quite a bit of concern about contamination and making sure that our gear and ourselves didn't contaminate the spacecraft. And now that that capsule is back with the sample, I'm assuming that a lot of those same concerns are there, that none of the earthly particles have contaminated this pristine sample from asteroid Bennu. What is that process like? And how do you go about doing the analysis and the investigations that you're doing while maintaining that pristineness, which I don't think is a word, but we're going to use it anyways, of the sample?
Quite right. We're more concerned about us contaminating the sample or Earth contaminating the sample than we are about potential hazards from the material itself impacting us. And so we have to be super careful that we keep everything clean. And that's why yesterday, if you saw the footage, or on Sunday, if you saw the footage, you would have seen the capsule, as soon as it landed from the helicopter, went straight into a clean room. And that's, again, to minimize the time it was in the terrestrial environment. So it went into a clean room and then went into a nitrogen purge. And we do that so that the sample and the capsule are contained in this flowing nitrogen that is inert, so it's not going to react with the sample. Things that we'll be doing, so today the capsule, very exciting, will be going to Johnson Space Center, to the team there, the curation team, who are world experts in taking care of extraterrestrial materials. Practically, things that we'll be doing, the sample capsule and canister will go into a glove box that is also nitrogen purged, and it will be opened at some point during the week, again, under a nitrogen purge. These are in clean rooms, so limited personnel, only experienced personnel with specific roles in the processing of the sample will be allowed in, and it will stay in that inert protected environment until samples are processed and allocated to the team. And we have, as a team, made special containers that allow a nitrogen purge so that they can be sent out to different investigators with some of that inert environment along with the sample, so that they're not being modified as they're transported across the world. And then individual laboratories have set up their own glove boxes and clean rooms in which to handle the sample when they get it, so that they can prepare the sample for individual analyses. So we're being very careful. We also have a contamination knowledge person on the team. Their role is specifically to make sure that different witness coupons and plates that are placed in the glove box or have been monitoring the environment on the spacecraft is experienced. We have all of that contamination knowledge so that we can compare it to our results from the sample.
It's fascinating. How much was OSIRIS able to collect? Because it seems like the sample is going to be distributed to many different teams. How much was collected, and is that enough to meet the needs of what you all plan for your analysis?
We think so. So while you may remember back to 2020, just after the touch and go sample acquisition mechanism was performed, so that touch and go to grab the sample, we looked back at the TagSAM head, so the collection device, and saw that material was spewing out of it. The original plan was to then swing that arm and that collector in space around the spacecraft to get a mass measurement, to measure the change in moment of inertia of the spacecraft with a sample compared to a previous test where there was no sample. Unfortunately, because the sample was leaking out of the container, we had to stow the sample very quickly and so weren't able to do that. But the very clever engineers on the OSIRIS-REx mission figured out that there was another way to do it. And so we have a pretty good estimate of the sample mass that was returned. We think it's about 250 grams. And so that's how much material we think has been brought back. And that's actually a huge amount for what we want to do. Our mission has been planned to the T, assuming that we return 60 grams of material.
Wow. Okay, so that's quite a bit more then, isn't it?
It's quite a bit more. And the science team gets 25% of that, up to 25%. So we're really working to a plan that is about 15 grams of material. And again, that's plenty for what we need to do to get a basic understanding of what Bennu's history is all about.
I have not heard it described as a tub of cream cheese, but that is fantastic. That puts it all into perspective. That's the best way to describe it. So now that you have this Philadelphia tub size amount of dirt, what's next for you, Jessica? What kind of analysis are you going to be doing on the sample that you get your hands on? And you said you've got 2 years to do this analysis. I mean, will we get everything that you all want to know out of this in 2 years, or is this kind of an ongoing investigation into what OSIRIS-REx sent back?
So I'm going to answer the second part first. The great thing about bringing samples back from space and keeping them in a pristine environment, having curators protect the samples and process them in the way they know how, is because those samples are then around for generations to come. So we will not answer everything about Bennu in these 2 years. And that's okay. That's what we want, because we want future generations who will be smarter than us, have better equipment than us, will be able to answer questions we've not even thought of today. So I imagine that Bennu's and OSIRIS-REx's legacy will continue on well into the future. And I'm living proof of that. So I was not born or around during the Apollo eras. Yet I study in my day-to-day, when I'm not doing OSIRIS-REx, I study Apollo samples using new techniques that were not dreamt of in the 60s and 70s. And those are the types of techniques that we'll be employing over the next 2 years. So we have a great team of researchers here at the University of Arizona. We have research staff, faculty, graduate, undergraduate students, and postdocs who'll all be getting to grips with this sample. We have all sorts of optical, electron, ion microscopes that we're going to be using to untangle the mineralogy of the return sample, its chemistry, and its isotopic composition. And so we just can't wait to get some sample in-house.
That was Jessica Barnes, an assistant professor at the University of Arizona and member of the OSIRIS-REx team. Still to come,
there were about a half a dozen things that under normal conditions would have caused a scrub. But the team, as it was assembled, had the ability to scrum, put their thoughts together, solve a problem real time, and move on without missing a beat and still getting it done in that 24 hours.
Launching a rocket in record time. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. With 24-hour notice, Firefly Aerospace successfully launched its Alpha rocket. This launch sets a new responsive record among commercial launch companies. Here to talk about the intense task of launching on deadline and what this capability brings to both the national security and commercial sector is Bill Weber, CEO of Firefly Aerospace.
Bill, let's talk about your latest mission. Very quick turnaround, and that was the point, right? Tell me what happened and why there was such a deadline on this mission.
Yeah, so last Thursday night, Pacific time, Firefly completed what is called Victus Nox. That was the mission name and title. It's a United States Space Force mission. And this was a responsive space mission. So in short, what that means is there was a 24-hour call-up window where Firefly had to prove that we could be ready to launch within 24 hours. Now, in order to hit the customer's desired target on this particular mission, we actually launched in 27, but we were ready at the 24-hour mark without going into too much of the specifics in order to hit exactly the orbit and the target that the customer desired. The first available window was at the 27-hour mark. So mission accomplished, mission achieved. Super exciting for the company. I cannot even begin to describe the energy that the team poured into this in order to get this done. And really what this means, what this symbolizes, is just a break from the conventions of long scheduled, far in advance, plan all the resources, a scrub is okay, we'll go again tomorrow or next week. This was compress everything down without sacrificing safety, quality, and reliability, and do things in parallel that were done in serial before, and compress this down so we could do things on call and responsive.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, I've been covering space for a few years now, and it does seem like launching a payload is a very long process from, you know, processing the payload, getting it in its fairing, preparing the rocket, fueling, doing all these checks. How did you manage to get this done within what is just an incredibly short time period relative to the industry itself?
Yeah, so there's two dynamics that had to be in play, and they really, it'll resonate with your listeners because it really does mimic life. If you want to get good and fast at anything, it requires two things. Number one, standardization of some things. You have to take some of the variability out of what you're going to go do. And so for launch, that entails some pre-planned orbital inclinations and flight paths and some pre-planned payload configurations. So when you limit those to a set of selections, then you can plan and drill and repeat. And so just like life, you have to limit some of your choices if you want speed. And you have to repeat it over and over and over and drill and look for efficiencies. And that's exactly what we did here. There were some preset locations that the customer said, we were going to ask you to go to one of these flight paths. And then there were some preset configurations. And then with those as our boundaries, we practiced over and over and over and looked for efficiencies so that we could get the payload configuration under the 60-hour window and the launch turnaround under 24 hours, and we were successful.
When you say you practice, I mean, is it a practical practice, or is this kind of a virtual? Like, how do you train for something like this? Because I don't assume you're just launching practice rockets all the time, but how do you practice for this?
Well, some of it takes a lot of the testing and preparation conventions of the past, and it just brings them into more of a compressed time frame. And so things like hot fires and wet dresses that are kind of the standard run-up procedure to a successful launch, we just did those multiple times over, and we did them in the same time frames that we expected. So we went from start to finish on those and did them within 24 hours. And if we weren't successful in that preparation, we went back to the drawing board, saw where we could get some efficiencies, and then ran the test again. And so like any, you know, I'll use a sports team analogy, like any high-performing team, the time you do it on the field in the game is rarely the first time you've ever done it. You've drilled that over and over and over in practice. And so That's how you do it. That's how we did it. And we were successful, and we're not going to go back. We're going to continue to operate that way.
Let's take a step back to the customer. I can assume why something like this would be so important, but in your words, why is this capability such an important asset to Firefly Aerospace and the customers that it is serving? Why do you need to be fast?
So from a national security perspective, our customer needs to be able to react or proactively respond to conditions that happen in space. And that happens, you know, in the kinetic battlefield today and around the world, where interests aligned with the United States often move and maneuver as a deterrent to be able to say, look, we know this activity has happened and you can't move uncontested in this region of the world or in this part of the world. And so space is an extension of that. And before what we did on Thursday occurred, there was a very, very, very long lead time capability to be able to put an asset to a specific location. And now we prove we can do it within 24 hours. So the deterrent capability from a national security perspective, which right now is our customer, is huge. It changes the game to allow Space Force to send very powerful messages that say, we're able to maneuver wherever you're able to maneuver and be aware. Now, from a commercial application, the very same speed and on-call capability that was demonstrated on Thursday night has absolute corollaries and applications in the commercial market space. And so when you think about the mega constellation, communication satellite constellation deployers that are putting up large satellite networks, now you have some flexibility and some capability to say, look, latest, greatest technology can be spared on the ground and sent to exactly the location where end of life occurs, a blackout occurs, loss in coverage, that sort of thing. And so to be able to do that on demand and do that at a moment's notice or within 24 hours or in the future, shortened timeframes, is incredibly valuable. So it has far-reaching implications. Like most things, the national security mission usually drives a lot of forcing function to say, look, we have to change the way that we do things. But there absolutely is a commercial application beyond this. And Firefly expects, as I said, to be responsive in the things we do, not just launch, but our landing capability ultimately, our orbiting capability with Elytra and what we do there. We have a mission coming up where we're going to do a very similar launch cadence, and we will put our orbiting spacecraft up within that same compressed timeframe so that, again, we hold our role in the market as the responsive space company.
Bill, it really is, like listening to you talk, it really is a paradigm shift in how these things are happening. And obviously there is the use case for national security. Do you foresee Firefly Aerospace as kind of leading with this technology and your customers are going to follow knowing they have this capability, or are customers asking for this already saying, hey, we need to be able to get stuff in there quickly?
There's no doubt there's commercial demand for this, but up to this point, it's hard to ask for something that does not exist. And so it's a desired state. The market's been looking for responsive space, particularly the DoD and intelligence community customer. It's been looking for responsive space for a long period of time now. And so now that it is here, Firefly won't be the only company that operates in this cadence. And so I think the operational horizons open up for commercial customers to say, the paradigm, as you said, was I got a plan. 9 months, 6 months, a year, in some cases, years in advance. You can look around the market and see launch capacity is being bought up in 2027, 8, and 9 right now as we speak because of fears that of scarcity of launch that they have to plan that far in advance. Well, this opens up a capability that if we build rockets and we keep them available, that you will have capacity, there will be capacity to be able to launch more on demand. And so then that opens up a completely different manner of thought on how do I operationalize getting assets to space? So we expect this to shift the market. There's no question, we're not an if you build it, they will come company. We don't operate that way. We wait for customers to say, we need you to do this. And it's why this mission was so critical and so important. It's why we pushed this one to our flight 3. Because it was worth holding the line for, you know, we haven't launched since last year at this time. And we did this strategically to say this would be the right next mission. And so if it means we launch maybe 6 months later than we initially had intended as our next launch, the qualifications and the credibility that we get coming out of this is worth it. It's worth it to the market overall.
I've talked with rocket engineers, you know, they love a challenge. That's why they get into rocket science like this. Tell me a bit about your team, one, you know, approaching this challenge, and two, you know, how do they feel after the success of something that is so difficult and that you were able to accomplish?
I'm going to tell you, there was no quit in the Firefly team. It's one of the things I love about this company. You got it right when you said they love a challenge. We started on the front end of this with seemingly insurmountable design and engineering issues on how would you get those activities compressed down. Even once those were all tackled, literally during that 24-hour window, there were about a half a dozen things that under normal conditions would have caused a scrub. But the team, as it was assembled, had the ability to scrum, put their thoughts together, solve a problem real time, and move on without missing a beat and still getting it done in that 24 hours. And I would tell you, there's a reason why you see the elation when that rocket achieved all of its goals. It's because that is their work, that is their hard effort that pays off right in front of them. And so I think if we let them, they'd go out to Briggs, which is about 20 minutes north of where we are right now, and they'd hand carry that rocket out to California to do Flight 4. They're that excited. So they know what they did. They know what they accomplished. And there's no better feeling. There's a lot of ways that you can make money out there and a lot of occupations you can have. There's not a lot of this kind of satisfaction in what you do on a day-to-day. So I'm super proud of everybody and happy for them because you can tell they're super excited.
Well, finally, Bill, what is next for Firefly Aerospace when they do hand deliver that next rocket to the pad? What are you most excited about?
we won't let them do that, by the way. We've got plenty to do. We're going to launch Alpha once a quarter. We'll launch again one more time this year. Similar mission. And then four times next year, once per quarter. We could probably squeeze that a little bit and get five launches out, but we're not going to push unnecessarily. It's important that we stay dependable and predictable. While we're doing that, the medium launch vehicle, the 17 metric ton version of Alpha that we're building with Northrop Grumman, it'll be done with development and testing, and we will ship that at the end of next year, and it'll be ready for flight. The Blue Ghost Lunar Lander, of which there are now three active programs using the Blue Ghost platform. The first of those missions takes off about a year from now. It'll orbit and land. So you can imagine that takes bandwidth and cycles. That's an entirely different challenge set. Same smart, same innovation and know-how, but applied to landing on the moon. And then Elytra, our orbiting spacecraft, it'll fly on its first Alpha mission probably in the late first half of next year. So we've got a lot cut out, but discipline and focus and dependability is what's going to mark this company going forward. It's why we took the time that we did in 2023 to get ready for 24 and beyond. So super excited. We know where we are in the market. We know who we are. I know others will join us in each of those areas, but we'll definitely be ready for launch, landing, and orbiting, which is what we set out to do.
That was Bill Weber, CEO of Firefly Aerospace. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.